Is it a good idea? Is it a good idea compared to what? Welcome to the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast. If you poke a sleeping economist with a stick, he's quite likely to swat away the stick with groggy words like, there's no free lunch, or compared to what, or what about at the margins, or other very similar phrases. Maybe there's no solutions, only trade-offs. And this is what our, well, conscious and unconscious reactions ought to be, especially when people come and poke us with the stick of a new economic proposal, such as universal basic income. So by the end of this episode, I hope that you'll be able to better answer those questions and give at least a basic layout of what some of the pros and cons would be, what those trade-offs would be, and when and where it might be a good idea, or a terrible idea, as the case may be. Now, Andrew Yang, in his recent presidential campaign, ran as part of his platform proposing a UBI, and it got a lot of interest. And that interest is coming back with the whole AI craze. Everybody is wondering what happens when the robots come and the robots take away our jobs. And we'll be getting into that one pretty in depth as well. Also, we're going to throw a few other things into this episode, in addition to all of our pros and cons and a little bit of a review about what the data says currently about the state of UBI programs, which are underway. And we'll be contrasting it to something very similar that you probably have heard of, and that's the negative income tax. All right, so first off, what on earth is UBI? Well, it's a cash, no strings attached transfer of money to everyone. And it's occasionally tapered off for the highest earners. And there's a variety of suggestions about just how much cash ought to be given. Let's see. For instance, there's two books which were fairly recent at this point, one by Charles Murray. And Charles says that we should do $13,000 per year, with $3,000 used for catastrophic health insurance. And he has a few other things in here. I think the benefits curtail once you hit about $60,000. He thinks it's only for people over 21, non-incarcerated, with a bank account. He projects in 2017 dollars that this would be about $2.8 trillion in the year 2020, and he thinks the majority of that would actually be financed by reductions in Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, various federal programs which are operative currently trying to do what UBI would be replacing. Andrew Stern says $12,000 a year, so $1,000 received monthly, for people from 18 to 64, with people over 65 receiving the payment only if they receive less than $1,000 a month in Social Security. And he thinks that's going to be about, again, in 2017 dollars, $1.8 to $2.8 trillion per year, which is a lot of money. And he, too, thinks that this will largely be financed by replacing a bunch of competing programs. Andrew Yang also proposed $1,000 a month or $12,000 a year for every adult over 18. And he wants this to be independent of work status, which is, I think, quite a controversial thing, though it's pretty par for the course in UBI circles. And he believes that this would enable Americans to pay their bills, educate themselves, start businesses, be more creative, stay healthy, relocate for work, spend time with kids, care for loved ones, and have a real stake in the future, as he puts it on his campaign website. He calls it the freedom dividend, and such a thing would require a constitutional amendment, he believes, which is pretty wild. He adds a stipulation where it'd be illegal to borrow or lend against one's dividend. So normally we see about $1,000 a month suggested, though more radical proposals have suggested a UBI at the poverty line. So that's about $15,000 for individuals or $31,000 per year for a family of four. Ideas like this aren't particularly new, and I would add that they're not entirely from the left. For instance, Milton Friedman suggested a negative income tax to restructure the ridiculously silly mess of poverty programs of his time. And rest assured, Milton, they got even sillier. A problem that he was trying to address was that the effective tax rates experienced by the poor are actually incredibly high. Now, obviously, in net, poor people don't pay any taxes, not even close. It's just the wealthier classes that cover all net taxes and are solely responsible for, well, keeping the lights on in our republic. But the effective experience of taxation by the poor is actually a real and legitimate concern. It's the poorest and the richest people who experience the highest cost to them for producing the next dollar. And therefore, it's trapping them in poverty. Let me give you an example. I worked with one lady who had 7 kids and started up a job where she was making decent money. This is years ago. She was making, I don't know, at least 30s, nothing crazy, but it was an entry-level position. And she decided to quit one day, quite unexpectedly, because she found out that all of the benefits she was receiving from the government were dropping off at an alarming rate, and that she's actually better off just staying home. She told us she'd be making $42,000 if she just didn't work, and she'd be worse off if she did work. That's what I mean by this effective tax rate, where the next dollar that somebody who's poor is making could be dropping off a dollar or maybe even more in benefits. So she made the economically rational decision to just stay at home and not work, even though she certainly could, and she was good at her job. That's not the only person I saw this happen to. I later, a number of years later, worked with somebody else who was making, oh, probably she could have been making, I don't know, 40, maybe even up to 50. But she too, having a bunch of kids and no husband, decided, well, I'll just stay home. And Milton Friedman is not alone in spotting this problem. Art Laffer, famous economist for, you know, the Laffer curve, points out that the effective taxes hit the rich and the poor the most. The effective taxes. I do want to remind listeners, poor people, although they might pay a tiny modicum of taxes, receive so much more back that they're just receiving stuff. It's, again, the rich who pay all the taxes. And we'll actually get to some data about that a little bit later. So he too suggests that we somehow need to restructure it so that poor people are not given disincentives to go and work and gain skills and participate in the labor force. So all that to say, we have people who are on the left who support a change of some sort to stop people having a high effective tax rate. And we have people on the right who are supporting similar schemes. So the negative income tax gives money at tax time to the lowest earners instead of giving them benefits. And this could be a pretty serious improvement to help the poor. My grandfather famously began work at a New York State Social Services department. I think he was running something there. He might have been running the whole department, knowing him. He found that at that time, I believe this was the 70s, only 10% of the funding actually reached the poor people. And the other 90% was just chewed up in silly administrative bureaucratic nonsense. So he famously declared that their entire department should be shut down and replaced by somebody who simply throws bags of cash at poor-looking people, because it would have a far better chance of actually delivering benefits. Again, the same impulse that, say, a Milton Friedman or even an Art Laffer have, certainly Friedman. So essentially, the negative income tax and the UBI are the same. They're largely the same. And this kind of goes, I don't know, it's not talked about enough. I think it does allow people to be a little bit more on the same page with identifying problems that we all see, like what I've been describing. So they both increase the progressivity of tax brackets while pulling the bottom up into negative tax territory. And this has the advantage of, down for the people who are receiving very little, removing stepped benefits, like those which drop off quickly at these arbitrary income thresholds, removing bureaucratic waste, because we no longer have to administer programs, because these people just receive enough cash to maybe not qualify, or we're just giving this in lieu, And it also reduces rent-seeking behavior, where people are focused not on being economically productive, but on somehow managing to get the most tax dollars sucked out of the government. So it does have these advantages. But the decided disadvantage for both UBI and the negative income tax proposal is that it's, well, as I said before, making the tax code more progressive. In other words, people at the higher end are paying a higher percentage, and people at the lower end are paying, well, in this case, a negative percentage. So even the liberal Washington Post, in an article by Dylan Matthews, states that currently the U.S. has the most progressive tax code in the world. So our top 10% of earners cover 45% of all taxes. While in Sweden, the poster child for progressive economic policy, the top 10% in Sweden only cover 26.7. And that's gross taxes. When we take into account net taxes, the fact that the bottom are receiving massive benefits, well, then the top is covering, well, the top 10% would, I'm pretty sure, be covering all. If not, we'd lower it to maybe the top 15% cover all. So that's the current state of our tax code. It's wildly progressive already, and a big downside is that given a UBI or a negative income tax rate, we're making it more progressive. That's a big problem. Now, I've argued elsewhere in other episodes that the most elite types of labor usually have what's called a low price elasticity of supply. In other words, the ability for the market to bring more of these highly compensated types of laborers to a given market is comparatively low. Let me give you an example. Doctors are ubiquitous on any list of high average incomes, and the American Medical Association limits the amount of slots in higher education programs for doctors, thereby limiting doctors. Certificate of need laws can limit the amount of staff that a given hospital can add, which is insane. The standards for becoming a doctor, which some of them are quite legitimate. You have to be smart. You got to be hardworking. You got to get certain scores on things. Well, that limits doctors too, as does the prodigious amount of time and expense it takes to become a doctor. So in short, if you need 1,000 people able to flip a burger tomorrow, you can find them. But if you want 1,000 people capable of doing brain surgery, or 1,000 people capable of writing code for quantum computers using neural networks, or capable of being the CEO of a company, well, good luck. It's very hard for the market to supply additional of these types of highly specialized laborers. So they're a group with a low price elasticity of supply, meaning we can't move up and down the supply of these people very easily. And as any textbook would then tell you, if you tax a product like this, i.e. their labor, as a low elasticity of supply, thus, right, just to remind you, a low ability to expand its quantity, then interestingly, the tax burden is shifted to the consumer, not the producer. What does all this mean? Well, it means the price will rise in approximate relation to the tax. There might be some split, but in large part, it will go to the consumer. And as a result, when the AOCs of the world, or the Joe Bidens, or the whoever's, sitting in their little Priuses, green with envy over the high salaries of the highest income brackets, decide to raise taxes on these type of laborers, then funny enough, what actually happens is the tax is shifted to those who pay for this type of labor. In other words, if we taxed all the doctors, then much of that tax would actually go to the people who are hiring doctors. It would increase the cost of healthcare. And a doctor would have a general stabilization in their take-home pay. So let's say they make $400,000 and they're currently taxed at 50%, so they take home $200,000. Well, if we tax them more because we were angry at their $400,000 nominal salary and we charge them, oh goodness, I'm going to have to do math on the fly, but let's say we charge them 75%. Well, now we're taking 300,000. We would expect their take-home pay to rise to about where it was before, to 200,000, meaning we find the next year they might be making 500,000. Oh no, income inequality has gotten worse. Why, we're going to have to be more progressive in our tax scheme. But that actually can make things worse. Now, I would like to see some research, and maybe it's out there, that shows the relative elasticities of supply for different occupations. I'm sure there's some data on that. And then we could use that to figure out what the split for the taxes would be when we tax their income. But that's another episode. I just want to point out that the progressivity of a tax code can actually, ironically, increase income inequality, at least nominally. And well, if your whole point was to make the whole income distribution quote unquote more fair, well, then this might not actually be the policy proposal that would even meet your objections or your objectives. So keep that one in mind. Let's keep on going. There's a bit of a digression, but I did want to point that out. There are other big downsides for progressive tax policies. We talked about how poor people encounter a higher cost to produce the next dollar. Well, the same would be true on the other side for those rich people. So if we have super highly compensated people, this means that there are very few of these people who can do a good job, a given job, and that the demand for them to do that job by society is extraordinarily high. So it's probably a fairly limited supply and a very high demand. Well, we want those people to be able, the market is saying, begging, please give us the next hour of labor. But if we tax them at a very high marginal rate, then they're going to have a disincentive to supply that next bit of labor. So that's going to hurt particularly sectors which employ such very high-level, elite, low-supply, in-demand individuals, and that's certainly going to be targeting economic dynamism. Right now, those could be people in the AI space and other burgeoning industries which do require very highly specialized people, and we need them working. So in the same way that we can agree with primarily, but not exclusively, left-leaning economists who legitimately point out that stepped benefits and different programs for the poor can create a high effective tax rate and therefore diminish their marginal desire to go out and work the next hour, well, they need to agree with us that the same thing would happen on the other end to the rich, and particularly if we're imposing a UBI or if we're using a negative income tax schema, which does increase the progressivity of any type of tax schedule. All right, digression over. Let's talk about a few other differences between the negative income tax and the UBI. I think there's actually some big psychological effects. And here's the biggest one I think that cuts in favor of UBI. And I'll demonstrate it with a quick quiz. Listeners, what tax rate do those making $30,000 a year experience? Do you know? I don't know. I'd have to look it up. What about $70,000? What about $250,000? I bet you can't tell me off the top of your head any of those answers. And I suspect that if we had a negative income tax environment, none of us would have a clue what people would actually be receiving. We just wouldn't know. And this means that we would still have the same consistent push to expand benefits for the poor presented by, you know, the so-called compassionate left, for example, pretending that we don't actually do anything for the poor, which I assure you we do. And in former episodes, I've cited many of those stats, even showing that the bottom 20% of earners receive more in benefits than the middle 20% of earners earn in income, which is insane, and a good reason why we should be investigating alternatives to that, because, well, there is enough money right now spent on the bottom 20% to make them as well off as the middle 20%, we just waste a ton of it. Thus, UBI does have some points in its favor. So, on this psychological effect, if instead of changing the tax rates and making them negative, which nobody will understand poor people actually receive, if instead every single American was receiving $1,000 a month, well, that would mean every single American would know that everybody else was receiving $1,000 a month. So when Joe Hobo comes up to you and says, "Hey, I need money. I don't have any money to eat any food. I haven't eaten in days. I don't have anywhere to live." You can say, "Wait a minute, you're living at that encampment over with your seven friends. Well, I mean, between the eight of you, you have $8,000 a month, bucko. You could go and get a mortgage on a sweet house. Maybe, you share a room, but, well, the majority of people are still going to be living way worse than you are in a nice new home in America. So you could pay the mortgage, have plenty for utilities, eat whatever food you want, and have everything be fine. You just have to move your encampment into a house. You have the money. I know you do, because we all have the money. Or at very least, if you hate everybody and you have to live by yourself, well, there are shelters. You could go to the shelter, and then your only expense is food. How on earth did you eat $1,000 in food already, buddy? Right? Like, there'd be a little bit of pushback for continually doting on programs which purportedly help the poor. And I think that's probably healthy that we have transparency in what people are actually receiving. And right now, we really don't have that transparency. And likewise, for those a little bit better off, say a family of four, they'd receive $2,000 a month. In Virginia, right now, the median rent is $1,440. That would leave $560 to cover utilities, maybe a little bit food. And if one person worked at a gas station full-time, that's an after-tax maybe $1,750 in addition to cover the rest of the food budget, car payment, cell phone, save a bit. That's a pre-tax $52,000. That's plenty. You can live a perfectly modest life in most places. And that's only with one person living at a gas station. And I will add that your favorite podcaster's regular monthly budget would be funded by that if I worked at a gas station and received UBI. You could live like your favorite podcaster does. No, not Trent Horn. Me. I don't know how Trent Horn lives. Probably in the lap of luxury. All the books he writes. But that's how it would shake out there. So all of this, the disadvantaged among us are just living in squalor, would be easily countered by, I know a piece of your budget. All you have to do is work full-time at a gas station, and things would be fine. So I think it would put a little bit of a halt on all that stuff. All right. So the big benefit here versus a program that simply just changes tax rates, particularly at the bottom, is that it's a public benefit. So it causes people to cast suspicion on the government poverty programs that are economically destructive, poorly administered, and always with their hand out for more and more money. Now, I will say here that I do believe that the act of moving money and just taxing to get the money and then sending it back to people is itself economically destructive. And it's actually more economically destructive than just doing what a negative income tax would do and just canceling it out. So all that there, we're going to put a pin in some of those things. We're going to have to explore that possibly in another episode about the effect of transfer and tax itself. But that's something I want you to have on the table. Moving on to something we learned from a University of Chicago Universal Basic Income and Negative Income Tax Review. This is a tiny quote from a article by David Tonady. He points out what most of us would have guessed, and that is that UBI reduced the poor labor supply less than a negative income tax. So giving people a UBI seems to have caused people to give up their jobs at a lower rate than a negative income tax. So why would we have guessed this if as we've said before, the net tax position is the same at any given point in the income strata. Well, in the negative income tax, one works more and sees that their portion of income retained dramatically falls as they face the headwinds of a more progressive income tax rate schedule. However, they take their UBI as a given. And in the UBI scenario, they're encountering a less progressive tax schedule than the negative income tax. So to give an example, to explain, let's say we have a flat tax environment of 30% and we have UBI going on. What would that mean? So at $0 earned, your tax rate is negative for the negative income tax. You get $10,000 in UBI. Even if you make $20,000 or $25,000, your net tax is still going to be negative. So let's say you earn $50,000 of your own, and this is taxed at 30%, but you get your UBI, remember, meaning your total income is $60,000 and your tax was $15,000, but that UBI is really just a tax rebate, so your net tax rate is 8.33%, or $5,000 of your total tax amount, or your total tax basis. If you make $90,000 and you're taxed at that same 30%, then that's a $27,000 tax. Minus that $10,000 UBI, your effective tax is $17,000 on the total of $100,000 of total income, or 17%. And all that's assuming a flat tax. It would certainly be much more wildly exaggerated if we layered on our current progressive tax rate structure, which makes it much worse. But there you can see that the UBI creates a progressive tax rate on total income, even if we applied a flat tax. So this shows that it is economically equivalent to simply a negative income tax at the beginning and then a higher marginal tax for the higher income earners. And I'll say that this whole progressive system is worse because it's going to be reducing the investment and savings rate, i.e. we will be eating a disproportionate amount of our seed corn instead of planting it. And that's because high-income earners are much more likely to save. They've covered all of their wants and needs. Some more is left over. That becomes investment. That causes long-term productivity. Whereas if we move that via any type of tax scheme or transfer scheme down to the people who make less money, well, they save very little, which means we get less investment, we get less savings, and we get less overall growth and productivity growth, which means we get lower future wages too. So the incentives at the margin seem a bit different with the UBI than the negative income tax rate for the person who experiences it, even though we could be pretty much just doing the same transfer. So let's say you earn $10,000 and you're thinking about taking a better job for $20,000. You won't think about your average tax rate as we calculated above, but the tax on the next dollar earned that stays at the consistent, say, 30% in our scenario. Now, it's true that if we canceled out that UBI, then it would be an identical actual tax position to if we just did the negative income tax. But in that scenario, you would see that you're being taxed at a higher rate on the next dollar. Therefore, I think at the margins, your incentive to work will diminish in the negative income tax scenario, but I don't think it will diminish as much with the UBI scenario, and that seems to be what we have from the research as we just quoted from that article by the University of Chicago. All right, in short, I would change my view that a negative income tax is superior if I saw compelling data on the economic destructiveness of the higher tax and transfer from the UBI, because I do believe that's economically destructive. And if that outweighed the advantages of UBI, those psychological advantages of people not perceiving the next dollar to be more expensive. I hope that section made any sense. Okay, on to the robots. So will the robots be better at everything than us? Well, let's just pretend the answer is yes, that the robots will be better at every single possible job. Does that mean we won't be working? No, not at all. Like, this is pretty basic economic stuff. Trade continues not based on somebody having an absolute advantage in doing everything, instead based on relative advantages. For instance, let's say the U.S. was better at making literally everything than Canada. Would that mean the Canadians just wouldn't work? Well, no. They would say, you know, maybe you're more productive at everything than us, but we're pretty good at maple syrup and hockey sticks. We'll just make those things, and then we'll trade for other goods and services. It doesn't even have to be nation to nation. It can just be with other laborers. I did a lot of restaurant work many years ago. So when I am, say, building houses and then get hungry and go to Burger King, why on earth should we have a Burger King worker there? Because I'm sure I could make my own burger much faster than him. Well, it's not a reason to say that therefore he should be unemployed and I should do everything, because if I did everything, that would take away from me building houses. And I assume I'm faster at building houses than the Burger King employee is. So we actually split up based on our relative talents. We're probably pretty close in speed making burgers, but I might be a lot quicker at building a house. Though, funny enough, at my local Burger King, there's a guy who's an electrician. And he just doesn't like being an electrician, so he likes flipping burgers. So I'm sure he'd be faster at that than me. But the fact of somebody's absolute advantage, any group of laborers' absolute advantage in doing work, is in no way a reason for other workers to not work at all. That simply does not follow. Instead, it just means that they would trade different things based on their relative advantages. And the same would be true if we have new AI workers, the robots, coming in to compete against us. So that's how it would work out. But let me give you a bunch of other reasons, too. So what does it mean to say that there would be no work for us to do, right? None at all. Well, that's saying that there is no one in the world that would wish for us to do anything for them. In other words, it rests on the notion that all people are 100% satisfied in all their desires. At which point, I might ask, why do we need UBI again? Or one might say, well, maybe they do want things from us, but they have nothing to pay us, nothing to trade to us in order to employ us. Well, this is kind of the reverse, right? That would imply that we have nothing that we would want anybody to do for us, which is quite strange. And we're all both producers and consumers. So if all consumers are satisfied, then UBI seems unneeded. And if all producers don't have anything that they possibly would even want in payment from anybody else, then wow, I guess they can produce and if everything we want with no desire for anything in return. Why, that's just another way of saying that all producers can produce everything for free. At which point, why do we need UBI again? And let me take a slightly different angle to say that everyone would be out of work because of the robots means that even at the margins, there's no value that could be added to anything through human labor. And I just find this to be extraordinarily unlikely. Let me read you something from a fancy car sales place called Refined Marquise. This is trying to advocate for you getting a Ferrari. It says a typical mass-marketed Ferrari, if there is such a thing, takes around 3 weeks to assemble. Notably, that doesn't include the time to build all the components. If you include all the manufacturing time, it takes about 3 months. To put this in perspective, Toyota estimates that it can produce a well-appointed truck or SUV in only about 18 hours. It takes so much longer to produce a Ferrari because of their hands-on assembly process and focus on performance. Some processes are automated, but only when extreme precision is required. Two robots, Romeo and Juliet, fuse the valve seats for the engines, which is impossible for humans to be accurate enough to fuse themselves. Beyond these processes, most of the work is done by hand. For example, workers still hand-stitch the leather upholstery to make sure it meets the company's standards. The V8s in these cars spend 30 minutes at each of 30 assembly stations, while V12s spend an hour at each station. In fact, all the V12 engines are assembled by a single engine technician. He or she follows it to each station and is solely responsible for completing it. So let's say that the robots can displace 18 hours worth of vehicle assembly labor. Does that mean everybody's going to settle for a Toyota? Or might they say, wow, Toyotas are dirt cheap. You know what? I do have the money to spend on a car. I'll spend what I would have spent on a Toyota before, but now they're a third the cost, on something even better than a Toyota. So it's not enough for robots to replace the whole economy. I think I speak for all of us when I say that I would like to live as a billionaire. Everybody in the whole world would like to live as a billionaire. And that means if the whole economy is replaced by AI, then we would just increase the quantity and quality of the things that we would like to have. In other words, I doubt that we will have AI output at the standard of living that we have now, and then all of us at home. No, if AI replaces all of the economy, then we'll probably still work and just have double the size of the economy. Us working and the AI working as well, even if they're absolutely better at everything than us. And then we'll receive double the value of goods and services. So it'll act as an enormous leverage, just like every other tool always does. And the tool doesn't demand a house and a car and a living standard of its own. So all of that redounds to us as consumption value. Now, even if the AI then replaces us again and again, then I don't know, maybe after a number of iterations, we could all still be working, giving that marginal benefit to one another. So maybe you would employ me to add another waterfall feature to your swimming pool. And then in return, I would employ you to hand-stitch that leather upholstery on my next Ferrari. Indeed, I would say the future is bright. Maybe, alternatively, we might choose more leisure. And that happens quite often with economic improvements in productivity. So in the end, however this shakes out, I absolutely guarantee that we will all be better off, at least economically speaking. So what about the distribution of income? Will it all just go to those who own the robots? Well, I seriously doubt it, because it's not like the robots poof out of thin air. In order to get these robots, there would be a wildly complex supply chain to get such things, and the profits will be distributed all along the way, and payments for land and capital and labor of all sorts will go into this massive economic move to produce again and again the robots. So all of these people along the way will be receiving a massive amount of wealth, in addition to the people who then get the final product, the robot, and are able to put it in production. And that aside, let's just pretend that some quote-unquote investment class, the rich, own all of the AI everything somehow. And somehow, with dramatically lower prices from the increase in efficiency, we don't have the ability to become investors ourselves. So somehow, even if these things are crazy productive and can outcompete everybody, that would imply that since they're competing against each other, the price of things would fall. And if the price of everything is falling, then we should have more disposable income to do things like, I don't know, buy shares of the AI company so that we could be part of this so-called investment class. So let's put all that aside, too. Let's pretend that that doesn't exist. Let's take the worst-case scenario where somehow that didn't happen. It would mean that at very, very worst, we would have a ridiculous, wealthy class of people that we could then trade with. they would either want that next waterfall in their swimming pool, or they wouldn't. They would already have everything. And if they didn't want anything in addition to what they're getting from their machines, then cool, I guess. They just built themselves a bunch of machines that serve their wants and desires, and they're over there not wanting anything from us. So they've essentially sequestered themselves from the economy while they have their respective AIs and robots competing on price and quality in our economy, making our standard of living rise. I mean, that's not the end of the world. Alternatively, maybe they do want that extra hand stitching on their next Ferrari. And now we're selling super luxury services to a class of impossibly rich people. I feel like we'll make plenty of money doing that as well. And even if we don't, again, we can still go back to trading with one another with all the productivity leverage made possible by our new tech aristocracy. So even in this situation, which is our worst case, I just don't see a great need for UBI. But there is one last argument about the robots. What if the speed of the change displaces people faster than they can retool and find new work? Shouldn't we have a UBI for that? Here, we'll take a quick pause and pick it up in just a moment. I will say I'm not a huge fan of having UBI for such things because I just think it violates subsidiarity. We're saying there's a big economic disruption and people could be losing their jobs. Therefore, not the individual, not their family, not their community, not their friends, not their church, not their local government, not their state government, not their company, not their civic institutions, not anything. No. We have to go all the way to the federal government to solve this problem? Wow. I really don't think so. So that needs to be on the table. But on an economic level, here's what I want. I want the economy to be dynamic enough to create jobs and very quickly reabsorb people that have their jobs displaced. My preferred policies would 100% be about increasing the economy's dynamism, making it fast on its feet to scoop up all that displaced labor. Further, I would want such insane economic growth such that irregular laborers are used nonetheless. So when you are hungry, you might pass up a cheeseburger because you feel like pizza. But if you are starving, you will eat boot leather. And the same is pretty much true for, well, using laborers in the economy. So if an economy is full of potential laborers, i.e. unemployment is very high, then nobody's going to hire a displaced accountant to become a carpenter. But if we have wild economic growth and very low unemployment as a result, well then, yeah, if demand for houses is skyrocketing and unemployment is low, then Melvin might get his chance to swing the hammer. And I think that UBI would require us to have very high taxes and/or very high deficit spending and thus new debt. Further, it would blunt the urgency to get oneself reabsorbed into the workforce. Though this second point gets a little bit more complicated, and we'll see a little bit of the data that's coming out of some studies a little bit later on. So my prescription during an AI boom that's displacing labor would be to take a flamethrower to burdensome regulations that slow economic flexibility, and there are Brazilian, so I won't even get started on them. Then I would suspend all capital gains tax so that people can buy and sell capital resources as unencumbered as possible to redeploy capital to match the new market's changing needs. I'd remove corporate income taxes, payroll taxes, maybe even income taxes, and maybe even all taxes too. The goal would be to give people and companies tons of money and tons of flexibility to figure out the best way to serve their neighbors in light of the entrance of these new AI laborers. Further, I would start signing free trade agreements until my pen catches fire so that we could have new markets to sell into, generating more demand for labor on our shores. And this would unlock an unprecedented amount of growth and get us through the difficult but exciting transition as quickly as possible. Because there will be disruption from the robots, from AI. So I think our priority should be, let's keep the disruptive period as short as possible and as painless as possible. And we can do that by getting a dynamic economy that is able to move resources as quickly as possible. And if we have very high economic growth during this time, then that's going to make the pain in aggregate a lot less. So in short, I'm basically following Art Laffer's protocol for how to handle the Great Recession, because we'd actually have a pretty similar issue regarding how to deploy labor and capital. So the bottom line of the robots, guys, is standard of living will soar. However, the transition will shake things up. And I think the way to deal with that transition is not to make the economy more stiff, more taxed, and more regulated. No, we should do exactly the opposite. We should say this is an opportunity to make a change, to make it fast, up our standard of living. Let's be fast on our feet here. Let's take down impediments to a dynamic economy. Let's get some serious growth, and let's find some new markets so that people can stay employed, because demand to give goods to not just the U.S., but the whole world is very high. That's what we should do. So don't worry about the robots, guys. Which leads us to our next section. If we don't need the UBI because of the robots and taking all of our jobs, well, what are the reasons for a UBI? And I'll be going through a number. And this is actually a mix of things that we hear from the right and the left. This one, first one, certainly a leftist argument. Equality. It equalities all of the poor people who are innocent and helpless. And I mean, that's, if you read the literature, it's pretty much that. Another one is kind of the standard argument that societal welfare is higher when we move dollars to those with a higher marginal benefit from a dollar, from those with a lower marginal benefit from a dollar. And I believe Dr. Lawrence White, a former guest, did a paper on this. I read it a while ago, and it really destroys this argument, because there's a lot built in. There's a lot of assumptions here, but we'll let that stand. You can go and see what he wrote about it. Another one is that it's better than a similar cost set of programs that target the poor, such as rental subsidies, welfare payments, food stamps, etc. And some of that is lower administrative costs. Some is we're removing geographically linked benefits so that we're trapping people in poor areas. Or we're removing stepped benefits so that we're removing people's desire to make the next dollar. And I think this is certainly the strongest argument. Next, that a permanent reliable income increases the human capital of people, or it encourages them to try out entrepreneurial behavior. I'd say that one's possible. And again, we'll be looking at a little bit of the data that's been coming out on this stuff. It's true that if one has a reliable source of income, they're more likely to, say, further their education. The data does show that. So then we have to ask if furthering one's education is just everybody standing in a crowd, or if it's actually adding to human capital. But that's another discussion. It allows people to engage in market undervalued work. Now, this is one that falls under the it equities people supposed benefit. Here it's saying, well, what about, you know, single moms who just have to care for their kids, and there's a significant amount of her time caring for children, which is certainly a benefit to society to have more kids, but she's not being paid for that. Or how about somebody caring for an elderly person? That's beneficial to society, but that's not paid work. Or we could multiply these things. A lot of stuff that people do isn't market valued, but this gives them money. Well, first, why on earth does everything have to be part of the market, guys? I thought it was the left that criticized the right for wanting to make everything part of the market, but here I see the shoes on the other foot. Second, I don't think it's actually paying for the labor. It's just paying people irrespective of their labor, so that seems odd. Next, I think that it's ignoring that there's a unit other than the individual, where there's actually choices that people make, that one spouse might stay home, maybe not for forever, maybe for a few years, maybe part-time, maybe here, maybe there. But that allows the other person to, say, work more. So the work value is realized, but not in that individual, but in the household. So it ignores that also. And I mean, I would add that taking care of an elderly relative. You're displacing a cost that they would have to hire somebody. So that is an economic payment, but it's a payment that's realized for the elderly person who has a better overall cash position because they didn't have to hire somebody who, actually charged for that payment. So that is economically valued. And a lot of those things are. It's just you're not tracing where the money was saved. You're just saying there was no money spent. And I don't think that's legitimate. But I wasn't supposed to be criticizing all these things. I was supposed to be listing them. So I'll press on. The next is people suppose that it increases civic participation, that it reduces crime, that it increases health and other positive metrics, that it claims to increase employment, saying that it allows people a longer period of time to find a good fit for a job instead of having to jump at the first thing. And it, let's get on to some arguments against. I think we've probably covered all those. Arguments against. Yes, giving people a bunch of money helps them in a variety of ways. All that's granted, whatever. But you're only measuring one side of the equation. You are taking money from other people to fund this, you know. So if giving people money helps them, well, wouldn't taking money from people hurt them? So this doesn't actually take into account the harm that you're doing by raising the money to then give away. Also, this tax and spend idea that puts money in the hand of people less likely to save will lower long-term growth. In other words, even if the poor are better off temporarily, the no UBI economy would surpass it in time due to higher productivity gains. So eventually, well, everybody's better off anyway. Next, that it does seem to disincentivize work because the urgency's not there. Your most basic needs could be covered. Another one is it's just plain old immoral. There is no moral justification for stealing money from people by force, and there's no moral justification by giving money to somebody without any merit. Therefore, it's just immoral. Full stop. We should oppose it. And I'm actually quite sympathetic to that argument. I could totally be persuaded that such a system is intrinsically immoral. It imagines that there is really a poor class, when in reality, people move up and down the income strata all the time. So it's trying to solve a problem that doesn't actually exist. If we look at people's lifetime consumption value, it's really similar. People are a lot more equal than one might think. You might be really poor in college, but then you might graduate as an engineer and make a lot of money. And then you might, take a few years off and try to start a business and make very little money and fail, and then go back and make a lot of money. Well, guess what? That's one person who's in the bottom 20%, then maybe in the top. You're a one-man inequality machine. Another objection is, well, why don't we just target the people who actually can't help themselves with real help and not just drug money? And let's just let people who can help themselves do exactly that. So maybe we need to rethink this whole thing and say the only people we really need to be funding help for as a society are people who literally can't help themselves and have nobody to help them. Past that, it seems like it's incumbent not on society, but on those people, and maybe on their individual communities, their family and their friends. Another big argument against is inflation. There's no way that this isn't adding to the deficit. It's just going to. Which means it's going to be running up debt. That means we're going to be increasing the money supply. And that means we're going to have inflation. So furthermore, we're going to have localized inflation in things which have that, inelastic supply. So all of our insane housing and building regulations mean that it's kind of hard for housing supply to jump up to meet demand. We're seeing that right now with the rising prices. So if we give everybody a UBI, we're also giving everybody who's bidding on a house $10,000 more. So what's going to happen? Well, they're going to run up their bids. Are they going to get anything in return? No, they're just competing for the same stock of houses. So the benefit doesn't go to them at all. So where's the benefit go? Well, it goes to the mortgage company. It goes to people who own the mortgages. And of course, it goes to the people who already own the homes. So it goes to older, wealthier people who aren't exactly the people we were trying to target. Also goes to people who own land. I don't see how a UBI is terribly helpful if we're actually transferring it to these groups. So inflation, yes, but also localized inflation. I mean, if we give everybody money to go and buy yogurt, then yogurt supply could increase and the price will remain roughly stable. But if we go and give them money to spend on the largest things in their budget, like housing, well, then we could very quickly be making a problem. So which of these arguments do I find most compelling on each side? Certainly in the pro column, I do think that we could argue that it's better than a lot of current systems. I would be interested to see the data that comes out about labor force participation, and I think we've seen some already. There's the only ones that I see as really strong or fairly likely. I don't think equality is a benefit, and at least Rerum Novarum says that it's not a benefit either. It's bad. You can see those episodes. Arguments against? I think all of those are actually good arguments against. There you go. So let's find out a little bit of the data about how these things are shaking out in the real world. I'll be pulling from what I believe is the largest group studying this. That's the Stanford Basic Income Lab. So they've collated a huge amount of studies, and let me see if I can pull up a little bit of their findings. They don't have magnitudes, but they do have directions of effects, which is probably because the magnitudes are probably small and they don't want to admit that. So let's talk about the summary of effects that they've seen so far. Income inequality, so how unequal things are, that got worse. Yep, we actually became more unequal with with the effect here. It says it's, yeah, positive. Income inequality by the Gini coefficient, that's another one. We have mixed data. One big analysis shows that it went down. One says it goes up. Stigmatization of labor market withdrawal. They show that the direction of association is negative. So people are less stigmatized for withdrawing from the labor market. That's not good. Labor market participation. They say the direction of association, negative. So we seem to have less people participating in the market. Wages and rates. One finds positive, one finds a no effect for their big analyses. So you might get a little bit more, and that could be that people have more time to find a better job. That's possible. Application to firms went down. People applied to less. Hiring by firms went down. Neighborhood job base went up a little bit. So that's probably because less people are taking jobs. There's more jobs available. Local employment, no effect. Increase in number of establishments, no effect. Eviction rates, no effect. Cost burden or housing availability, that went up, right? And that's something we predicted. So you give money to people to go and compete on housing, your housing cost goes up. Improvement in living arrangements or housing, that was found to go up. So these people got something a little bit better, but it did cost more money. Violent crime, one found it went up, one found it went down. These are community effects they're looking at here. Property crime, that went down and down, so that's good. Socially relationships, that's vague, but they said that's better. External political efficiency, down, whatever that means. Civic obligation went up. Political behavior, they believe, went up. Political activity went up or no effect. And social inclusion, they believe, went up. That's kind of mixed, I would say. And if you read a lot of the other places reporting how things went, that's what you'll generally find. There's mixed data on how well this works. Certainly things like, do they have enough food or are they in poverty? Yeah, those things are going to get better because you gave them a bunch of money. And occasionally it can prop up some other stuff like being entrepreneurial, etc. But in general, it did kind of match with some of the things we predicted, like higher home costs, lower desire to actually be working, etc. So given all these pros and cons that I've listed, let me give you a bit of an answer on if we should do this or not. We have no if and yes if. So I would say we should not do this if we'd be adding it to the current pile of benefits. So unless the additional income would disqualify enough people to pay for itself, then I don't think we should be implementing this unless we're actively destroying all other silly benefits. Because really the biggest pro to this is it's replacing inefficient programs. And if it's not doing that, we shouldn't do it. Also, we shouldn't do this if it's financed by debt. Government debt outcompetes for savings, and it's also channeling stuff into consumption, into eating our seed corn instead of planting it. So I don't like the idea that we'd be using debt to finance this. I think that's an awful idea. It would also lead to inflation, which would diminish the effect of the UBI and generally slow down the economy. So I just don't think that'd be a good idea. No, if the minority of actually useful targeted programs for the poor are shut down. So I'll say on the other hand, if we're going to be doing a UBI and then just abandoning every program, even the actually useful targeted programs, I think that's a problem. Recently, we have the crazy cannibal hobo guy in California who found a severed leg and started gnawing on it. That guy is nutty, and he needs to be collected and institutionalized because it's not humane to let him be running around in such a state. That's just not right. Nobody should descend to the level of cannibal on the streets without intervention. So if we're going to do a UBI and say, everybody's on their own now, not a big fan. I think we should keep a small minority of targeted programs, which would say locate and help incredibly crazy cannibalistic hobos, for example. So I wouldn't want this to become an excuse for apathy towards the needy, though I do see as a benefit that it gives transparency about what we're actually giving to the needy. I'd also say no if the UBI would be offered to, say, illegal immigrants, and this would create a perverse incentive to enter the country in order to receive free stuff instead of meaningfully contribute to society. It would also drive more people to the border, which is unsafe for them, funds cartels, etc., etc. And finally, here's one that people don't really think of. If you could sign up as an illegal immigrant, which means you could arrive through the border without being stopped, you could also go back through the border without being stopped. So what would stop somebody, say, from France arriving, declaring themselves an illegal immigrant, signing up for UBI, and then just going back to France and collecting the cash? It's not like you're being tracked. So I think this would create some perverse incentives, and it would have to be limited to legal citizens. Also, know if it's automatically linked to inflation. So if we say it's $1,000 a month, and if we get 10% inflation, y'all get $1,100. Because people might think inflation was good because they'll see the amount of their UBI rising. And that's not what we want people to think. Also, it could create a very, 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 very vicious cycle, especially if it's being debt financed, of inflation feeding on inflation, indexed to inflation with more inflation. So that's bad. No, if the alternative is a non-universal benefit that is only for low earners. So this would create the stepped benefit, which is bad. So no, if this is only for low earners and some universal so-called basic incomes drop off quickly. For instance, the one that we read at the top of the episode dropped off at around 60,000. I think it even curtailed beginning at 30. This is creating a type of stepped benefit. This is creating an experience of a higher marginal cost to earn that next dollar because some's going to be taxed away. And I think that's going to blunt the effectiveness of such a scheme. So I don't like universal basic incomes that only target low earners because it shares a lot of the problems that the current systems have. I would add no if there's no permission for removing the benefit. So we don't want to be giving people gasoline and matches to light their lives on fire because that's cruel. So let's say if you're a wild drug addict, then I think your UBI should be suspended unless you're actively becoming sober. And likewise with criminals, we shouldn't be funding criminal groups, right? We would need a provision to turn this off, so I don't want it fully universal. And that leads me to my next problem, which is kind of intention, which is I would not want this to be a political tool. For instance, let's say parents who believe that gender-affirming care is nonsense and that schools shouldn't be able to send off your kid to be mutilated. Canada's pretty much already there. And if our government took that kind of stance that you're a child abuser for not affirming your kid's so-called gender, well, that could be impetus to say shutting off cash to these families. I don't want the government to have leverage over people for political purposes. So although I think that there should be provision to shut it off for some people, I worry this could be abused. So this is pretty difficult to design one that avoids all of these no's. And I'll add another general restriction or addition. I'd say that Andrew Yang's wanting to bar borrowing or lending based on the UBI is a reasonable thing to say. However, I'd say that it should be unlocked with certain markers of fiscal responsibility, or maybe a certain income level so that people can borrow based on this. I think there should be provisions for that because I do think it's a useful financial tool to borrow, but maybe not all situations. Here's some situations that I would say yes to UBI. If this destroys all other programs for the poor and is mostly or completely funded by their shutdown. So if we just figured out how much we're spending and that became the check, then yeah, I'd say I would probably support that if it was entirely funded by the shutdown of current programs because of their stepped benefits, because of their geographic location, because of their rent-seeking behavior, and because of all those other problems I listed. And I would add I'd also want to pressure state and local governments to also remove these type of bad benefits and replace it with piggybacking on the UBI system. I'd also say yes if stats on family formation could be shown to significantly improve, and I would need to actually see those numbers in depth. So in general, conservatives don't think that money can help, and I mean, that's an empirical question, but I do think that money can certainly hurt family. So financial incentives can certainly destroy families. We saw this in the 60s where we had a lot of the war on poverty stuff destroying homes, particularly in poverty-stricken communities where mothers were incentivized to divorce and to live alone because, well, the government would come and pay them way more money. So if financial incentives can destroy families, I'd say at the margin they could make families less likely to be destroyed or a little bit more stable or maybe even optimistically slightly more likely to form. And something that could help this out, and I'd really need to see some numbers, and there's a lot of caution here because there's no solutions, only trade-offs. Maybe there could be a little increase in UBIs for stable homes. So it's 10,000 and 10,000 for, you know, mom and dad. But if they get together, they're married and they're in a stable home, maybe that increases to 22. I would be open to seeing those numbers and those tests, but I would be highly skeptical. Next, if it turns out that the stability from the UBI vastly increased human capital in such a way that we could measure a large economic benefit, maybe from increased successful entrepreneurship and other things, then I would be more open to a type of UBI, at least one that exceeds simply the amount that we would get from shutting down all poor targeting programs, except for the ones for people who truly can't help themselves. Finally, this is probably the most controversial of all. I think I would say yes to a UBI if we made this fairly wild trade that those who receive more in benefits, like the UBI, than they pay in taxes would no longer be able to vote unless they choose to pay the difference and be actual contributors to the system that they wish to have a voice in. The key problem for democracies through all time is that eventually 51% of people realize they can vote themselves the other 49% of money. We see democracies commonly kind of have ballooning debt, wild inflation, that's kind of a hallmark. So having people who actually foot the bill be the ones that vote about the spending just seems fair. And for those who are worrying right now about having a permanent upper class, no, most people would be a voter at many points in their lifetime. So according to Mark Rank, who we've quoted extensively in other episodes, turns out that 12% of the population will find themselves in the 1% of the income distribution, at least in 1 year in their life. And if you're wondering how much that is, that's $819,000 as of 2021. So just think about your, I don't know, your class in elementary school, your third grade class, all the people who were there, maybe 25 kids, about two of them at some point will make $820,000. 39% of Americans will spend at least a year in the top 5%, that's 335,000. 56% of people, so more than half of people, more than half of all the people you've ever met, will find themselves in the top 10% of earners, at least at some point. In other words, $167,000. And 73% of everybody will spend at least a year in the top 20%. I mean, I don't know how much money that is, but that's incredible. So everybody will get a chance to vote, but when you're voting, it's got to be when you're actually contributing. I don't think that's unreasonable, and I think that would make an interesting set of political incentives. All right. Well, let's sum this up. A lot of this is in the context of income inequality, and we've talked a lot about this on our podcast. I have an entire episode, maybe two episodes, dedicated to income inequality. And most stats that you hear on this subject are extremely deceiving, and I could see why somebody might want to respond with a wild policy tool like UBI or a more progressive income tax. But it's important to actually dig into what on earth these income inequality numbers even mean, because a lot of what's presented to the public, even by a lot of economists who definitely should know better, but are nevertheless either full-scale propagandists or about as academically astute as a panda bear, are terribly twisting the facts. So here's a few things that they don't typically adjust for, just to remind you. When you hear household income being quoted, that's a huge red flag. Why? Because in the top 20% of earners, there's on average 2.1 earners in a household. Whereas on last check, in the bottom 20% of earners, there's only 0.45. So less than half of one wage earner per household in the bottom 20%. So when you correct for the number of wage earners in a household, well, all of a sudden, those big bloated income inequality stats come crashing down. And of course, people in the higher income strata have more hours worked. They have massive taxes, and then those taxes are transferred to the bottom 20%. So if you account for all of that, it gets way lower, this supposed income inequality. And I go through all those numbers in former episodes. And if these people had a lick of sense, they would also account for age. Recall, in a previous episode where I was busting some economic myths, one myth was that there's a racial gap that shows up in the income data. I showed that just one variable can account for all of the income difference on average between black men and white men. And that is, there's a much more economically important difference than the color of their skin. It's their age. On average, a black man in America is 35, and a white man is 45. And if you look at the average gap between a 35-year-old and a 45-year-old's income, well, it explains all the difference between the average black man and the average white man. It's because, well, the black guy's younger. And of course, in that episode and others, we've accounted for geographic distribution. And I'll kind of put a pin in that one. Think about what a UBI would do in light of the fact that there's wildly different local economies. It would actually incentivize people to move from places with localized inflation, with higher costs of living, to areas which are cheaper to live at. Listen, if that's done on a purely economic ground, like a market-based decision, then that could be a perfectly rational choice. But if instead we're just giving the same dollar amount to everybody, then we could be pushing people into less economically productive areas where they're going to find that, yeah, their cost of living's lower, but their wages are very low, and the amount of the value they create for their neighbor is consequentially quite low as well. So that's a problem. I'll just throw in a few more things here. We have dug into income inequality a lot, showing also the factoring in the cost of education and the time that you are not receiving wages, and seeing what a reasonable return on that would be and how that would create a differential amount of pay for people who pursue higher education versus people who don't. And we've also examined volatility in various labor, showing that on average, contractors make 1.5 times more wage earners. And this actually holds true even for other types of variable income professions. For instance, waiters and bartenders earn just about 1.5 times more similarly skilled professions in their local economy. All this stuff can be done pretty simply, pretty easily, even by a little rinky-dink podcast like mine, and dramatically reduce the headline inequality numbers. But it's entirely ignored by the vast majority of people who are pumping this nonsense. So this is something I want to immediately pop up in your mind whenever somebody suggests UBI, because they're probably targeting some type of inequality concern, be it from the robots or from any other economic whatever. Maybe it's a trade issue that they're concerned about, that trade with China will take away jobs. We need a UBI. Whatever it is, it's usually centered around some type of income inequality issue, since this is, after all, a redistributive policy. And I want you to think twice whenever somebody brings that up, because the numbers are not what they seem. It just takes an ounce of common sense and a small amount of math, and you can dig through and find the truth. And we've done that many times. Also, in general, I oppose any new government spending, because government spending creates little to no value. And even the government will admit that if you look at what's called the money multiplier, a measure which I have many problems with, but nevertheless, tries to estimate how much economic activity a dollar spent makes. Even government sources will show that government spending is far less effective in creating economic activity than private spending. And that's obviously a problem. And just in a more common sense way, sit back and think for a moment all the benefits you get from your house, your car, your phone, your insurance, your grocery store, your power company, all those things in life. What percentage of the value do we, the people, get from the government? I would argue it's very, very little. And what proportion of the GDP of all economic activity is simply government spending at the state, local, and federal level? Well, if you take the OECD number that factors in a wide variety of things, including public institutions, like public colleges, that number is 45% of the whole economy, which is insane. If you take the IMF numbers, it's closer to 36% of the entire economy on the last check. So between a third and a half of all the money in our nation is spent by governments. UBI would make that higher, and I don't like that. I don't think they spend it wisely. I don't think we get much bang for the buck when governments spend it. I think just take those numbers and think about how much value the government creates and how much value all the private institutions that you cooperatively engage with produce for you instead. And for the Merodes crowds, as the memes go, but what about Merodes? Yeah, that's 7% of the state budget on average, and 4.5% of local budgets go to roads. Education's a little bit higher, but a lot of this is stuff which I don't think people would actually want to voluntarily pay for, which is why taxes are taken by force. So is UBI a good idea? I would say possibly. Maybe if we got some really solid research, and I'm going to look at it with a very critical eye, it may be an improvement over our tragically inefficient mess of supposedly caring for the poor operations, which are funded publicly. And if I were to bet, I would say that it probably would be an improvement over these, so long as the details of UBI's implementation weren't terribly screwed up. So if it's a choice between a lot of the current poverty programs and UBI, I'm going to give a slight edge to UBI. And that comes with a lot of small print on my part. And one of those, well, this it wouldn't even be small print. Here's a big print issue I have with it, and that is funding. Because if we're funding it with debt, if we're funding it with taxes like wealth taxes, and these are commonly proposed in light of UBI, or corporate income taxes, or capital gains taxes, the results would simply be catastrophic. However, if it was funded by a very well-thought-out consumption tax, that would partially blunt the savings diminishing effects of transferring cash to those who save very little. And in general, that type of tax would be much less economically destructive. Heck, even an income tax would be a bit, well, those are pretty terrible too. Yeah, I would say if we used a consumption tax, that would be your best bet to be able to raise this much money in a way which wouldn't be economically catastrophic. But my favorite solution is not the status quo, and it is not UBI. It is not any type of government-tailored policy whatsoever. Here's my favorite solution by far, and it's very simple. How about people just care for the people God has given you? All the people in your path who you can care for, who need things, just take care of them. No government needed. Shut the whole thing down, and let's have personal responsibility paired with charity. And while we're at it, let's focus on how to make stuff cheaper and not just how to bloat nominal wages. Why does this always have to be the discussion? This is one of my hobby horses. Everybody says, how are we going to care for the poor? Well, let's give them money. It's like, whoa, what if we made their current money spend farther? Because capitalism has an incredible record of success in making things cheaper, more affordable, and more accessible to the masses. And the government has a pretty shockingly horrible record of redistributing money in order to try to make prosperity. So let's do the thing which is proven and easy and has a clear path. Let's drop the price of things so that standards of livings rise. Big cost is housing. We've done episodes on how to reduce the cost of housing. It's not hard. It's easy. We just remove some really stupid regulations and blam, it's there. And hey, if you have another particular thing you'd like to know how to lower the cost of, email me. Maybe I can do an episode on that. If you look at higher education, healthcare, it's insane. It's ridiculous. It is obvious how we could reduce these massively, and that would certainly benefit the poor and everybody else, and it wouldn't require a massive tax and spend system. These types of policies, UBI and other types of redistribution, other schemes, I would say at very worst, they represent a massive power grab by the government. And at best, they're simply just a Band-Aid on our wounded potty politic that ought to be healthy with those two things I named earlier. It ought to have personal responsibility and charity and not just Band-Aids of redistribution. We shouldn't need those things. None of this should exist if we simply act virtuously. It's just an institutional attempt to fix what is our aggregate of individual vices. So my favorite is, let's make it not a problem that needs to be solved. We can use the market to bring down costs. We can use private charity to care for anybody who's going to slip through the cracks. And then we can support individual responsibility to embrace the struggles which are given us and then to succeed anyway in our wonderful country. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode, guys. I must admit, it was a bit of a slapdash, thrown together quick, kind of half-baked episode. So I really hope that we achieved some of the goals that we set out with, understanding the pros and cons, understanding what extraordinarily narrow times this might be a good idea, and the many times when it's an awful idea, and how to know the difference. I hope you all have a phenomenal Easter. You're probably listening to this after Easter, so I hope you had a wonderful Easter, and I hope you join me for the next episode. As always, thanks for listening.